succession number 30079, reel 3.
This is the second reel of a tape interview with Bill Atting and his home in Perth, in Australia, on the 20th of the 4th, 2007, with the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, we've been speaking about your experience in relation to arriving in Brighton. I wanted you to discuss with us, if you could, a little bit more of your recollection of Brighton during the war. You mentioned that there were over 600 pubs for you to choose from. You were afraid that you might get bombs dropped on your head, but that didn't happen. Let's talk about what you can recall of Brighton and the atmosphere of a place like Brighton during wartime.
Well, we were all associated with Australians, as far as I can remember. We did have RAF drill instructors that marched us around the town and showed us the various places to go to. And my recollections of it was that it was very much a wartime seaport or sea town. It had barbed wire barricades all along the seafront, and the piers were guarded. Apparently they were concerned about any invasion by the Germans. As you recollected, there were 600 pubs we were told about. That didn't interest me, because being a non-drinker, it didn't concern me.
What was the war spirit that you sensed in a place like Brighton, an old holiday seaside town, the old holiday seaside town, as people would say?
Well, there was no fraternisation with the local town folk. We didn't fraternise with them because we were kept to one side. We were billeted in these taken-over hotels, which was the Grand and the Metropole. I remember them now. They were fairly close together. And apart from the usual going to the odd dance that may have been held in the town, that's about all I can remember at that time.
What were those occasions like, the old dances in the local...
Oh, they were quite enjoyable, yes. Yes, quite enjoyable.
Presumably organised with local WAF and people like that.
Well... Yes, some WAF, but mainly the town's girls. Apart from that, the usual shops that you go into to see what you could buy.
How did the locals treat Australians from the other side of the world in a place like Brighton?
Well, as I say, we dealt mainly with service people. Very little to do with the townsfolk, apart from, you know, the business houses. And of course, they'd seen so many of us that they weren't particularly interested.
Let's talk then about how your career in the Air Force would progress from this point. And you mentioned, obviously, that you would have further training.
Yes, and my first further training was with the Tiger Moth people. At a place called Desford. It was an elementary flying training school, and they had the Tiger Moth aircraft, and we had one or two flights there. That was about all, just to familiarise ourselves with the area. And I had very serious concerns about the climate in England, because in the one particular flight that I can remember going up in, I wondered why the instructor was waggling the controls consistently. And I asked him about it over the intercom, and he said, well, look up there. And I put the ailerons controls. As water hit it, we were in rain, it turned immediately to clear ice. And he said, if I don't keep it waggling, it'll lock up. So that was my introduction to the first flight in England in winter.
Well, that's one thing that people who haven't experienced, obviously, what you have, wouldn't immediately think of. You come from an Australian sunny clime, and off you go to the English climate, and suddenly you've got to relearn how to fly almost.
That's right.
As a result of this weather difference.
And the built-up area too was foreign to us, because where we had done our initial training was at Cunderdon, and there was miles and miles and miles of just farmland. Very different.
Literally, as far as the eye can see, almost.
That's right.
In relation to your further training, obviously you mentioned tiger moths again, but you presumably progress from tiger moths.
Yes, from tiger moths we went to the Airspeed Oxford, which was a twin-engine aircraft, and that was at a place called Kidlington, and it was known as an advanced flying unit.
Here you are. You're looking at your logbook here, and we're talking of October of 1943, as your arrival in Brighton.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah, well, at Kidlington we were there in February 44.
Okay. What was it like being on an airbase, being a flyboy in a wartime situation?
Well, there again, I was only associating with fellow RAAF men, apart from the RAF instructors.
What was life like, though, on the base? What do you remember, presumably?
I don't remember much about being on the base. You know, they're all very similar. You had a mess and you had a drill parade ground, and we didn't have a great deal of drills to do. It was mainly involved with the flying. And what I remember of that, it was quite a good experience. The weather apparently was much better, and the visibility was improved.
Obviously by this period, early 44, Germany is on its, you know, on the back foot, and allies are going to invade Normandy in the not too distant future. What was the general feeling amongst the airmen in relation to the situation?
Well, I think the general feeling was that we're in the wrong country. We should be back with the approach of the Japanese, who were coming down so rapidly in the islands. But of course, we could do nothing about that. We just had to continue with what was set for us in the UK.
So what did training involve in the Oxfords?
Just the usual, mainly circuits and bumps, as they call them, and the odd cross-country. And I had a very good instructor at the time. I can remember he was Sergeant Fox, and he had a very good knowledge of the area, whereas if I had taken over from doing the navigating, we'd have been still up there, because it was Oxfordshire, and he flew around the universities and all built-up area, and a lot of times he'd just let me stooge along, and he would read his book. And then after a while he'd come out of his book and he'd say, well, where are we? You know, and he'd look over the side and I'd say, I wouldn't have a clue. And he said, well, oh, that's so-and-so, steer 270 and we'll be right. And he'd get me back to the base.
Doesn't sound like a huge amount of urgency.
No, no, there wasn't. He would know exactly where he was.
But in relation to a young chap, was there any sort of concern that you might miss out on the action if you didn't hurry up and get on with something?
Not really. I just took things as they came, which I have done all through my life. And they had the upper hand, so I didn't argue. if they sent me to another base, well, that was it.
Presumably, though, this is all leading to one thing, and that is the operational flying.
That's right.
When was it that you would crew up, and what planes were you sort of being led to with all of this training?
Well, we were allotted to Bomber Command, which could mean anything from two-engine Wellingtons to four-engined Halifaxes or Lancasters. So they took you through those three aircraft, and then they made their final decision where you would go. And, of course, where you went meant the type of aircraft that they had. And
were you hearing anything about the tactics of the war? Was anyone telling you anything about possibly the plans of the Allies to invade, for instance, Normandy?
No, all they told us were that the strategic bombing of the occupied territories and Germany were the way to go. And so that's what we more or less expected we would be involved with.
What were they telling you about those tactical operations? How are they describing the bombing raids that were going on?
Well, in strategic bombing, they were saying that they could have up to 1,000 aircraft on a single target to demolish everything that they could. And it was said that there wasn't a great deal of accuracy. It was just saturation bombing, and with the hope that they'd bring the country to its knees. And it was only if we showed any sympathy about it, they always referred to what the Germans had done to England, London and Coventry, for instance, and all the other principal towns. So they said it's only a tit for tat. So we went along with that.
Well, people talk of day and night bombing raids.
Yes, well, we did both. We had 8 daylights and 28 night raids.
Well, we can talk about those as well, obviously. It would be good to discuss the differences between and that sort of thing. Were you in touch at all with American airmen?
Only so far as when we were diverted to a US base, you know, on account of fog at our own base, they would divert us to a US base, where we were well received, very well received. We usually only stayed overnight and went back to our own base the next day.
When you mean well received, what did that... They
made you very welcome, and as you walked in the door, they gave you a satchel which had all the necessary toothpaste, toothbrushes, shaving gear, and any other incidentals. And their food was better than what was provided at our own base.
Well, I've heard a number of stories, and often people talk about how the Americans had it better. They were better equipped, they were better stocked, they were better paid.
Yes.
Their uniforms were better.
Yeah.
Was there ever a sense of sort of competition, us and them?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, there was general saying about them being overpaid, oversexed, and something else I can't remember.
Over here. That was when they were over here in Australia, and presumably...
It was the same in England.
In England.
Oh, yes. There's more so over there.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I don't know. There must have been a greater number of them in the UK. But there was plenty of them there. And they fraternised quite readily with the UK ladies.
They had a better way with them.
That's
My
right.
My impression is they knew how to talk to a lady.
Oh, yeah, and they had silk stockings and chocolate.
Plenty of cigarettes.
Yeah.
In relation to your further training, presumably at some stage you would be allocated the type of plane, but you would also have to crew up. Let's talk about that. What planes would you end up flying, and what was involved in being crewed up?
Well, it was an unusual circumstance as far as I was concerned when we crewed up. I think it may have been at a place called Gamston. I'm not absolutely certain on that. But we were put in to a more or less a drill ground, you might call it, a parade ground, more correct, and all sections of our crew were intermingled, and they told you over the public address that the pilots as captains were to choose a crew. And I approached a building, and as I did, there was two figures came around, and they were both officers. I was a sergeant, and I recognised immediately one of them as being a chappie I had known for a fortnight in WA here in the CMF, the Citizen Military Forces. And it was Kerry Guttridge, and he was the navigator looking for a pilot. So we clicked straight away, and he had as his friend Bill Morrow, the bomb aimer. So he said, well, I'll come with you if you'll take Bill. And I said, no worries. And from then on, there was the wireless operator and the gunners. And we all got together and decided that we'd form the crew and give it a try. If we didn't get on, well, we'd make changes. But as it was, we stayed together.
We have here on top of your bookshelf a model of a Lancaster.
Yeah, that's the model of my favourite, the D-Dog.
Mm. Okay, well, next to it we have the mascot.
Ah, yes.
Looks like an old black Scotty.
That's right. That was one that I made up myself in hospital in England prior to leaving Brighton. And
we haven't heard that story. Tell us that story.
Well, I'd had this trouble with the spine, the base of the spine, in Australia, and they treated me for tinea, much to my disgust, because it never seemed to clear up. Well, it would clear up and then break out again, like a sore, and it wasn't until I was on the ship going to England from New York that it flared up because lack of showers, and I went and saw the MO on the ship, and he examined me and he said, you know what this means? And I said, no. He said, it means an operation and you better see about it once you get to England. Which I did, so I was admitted to the Royal Sussex Hospital, fairly close to Brighton.
Mm.
Mm. And was there that I made my mascot up.
Does it have a name?
Raf.
Yeah. In relation to, and we could talk about Raf and possibly his importance as a mascot a bit later on, but in relation to Lancasters, what was it that you knew about Lancasters?
Oh, very little. Only from photos and the diagrams that I'd seen. And I wasn't to know that I was going to finish on them, because we went through the Wellingtons, the Halifax and the Lancasters. It was only a very brief time with the Halifaxes, because they must have had us in mind for a Lancaster squadron. And that's where we finished up, at Binbrook with 460 Squadron, RAAF, who had Lancasters only.
What was it then when you first went up in a Lancaster? What was involved? Tell us what it's like to fly a Lancaster.
Well, it was brilliant, and I had no trouble at all. I did better on the Lancaster than what I had done on the Wellington, firstly, and then on the Halifax. And I'm very proud to say that I got above average as a pilot on the Lancaster on the initial flights.
How did they compare?
Oh, difference between chalk and cheese, as far as I was concerned. Mm. much more manoeuvrable and apparently easier to land, because that's why the instructor gave me above average. Mm. I landed them very well in those days, as I remember.
How long were you on Wellington's for?
It'd only be a guess, possibly 3 months. That was only at advanced flying unit.
Mm. So you were only training on Wellington's at that point?
Oh yes, you only trained on Wellington's. Mm. They were still possibly being used in ops, but they were mainly training for our purposes.
So Halifax, how did that compare between a Wellington and a Lancaster, in your opinion?
It was, it seemed to be heavier on the controls, as I remember, and I didn't manage it anywhere near as well.
Given that you were to spend your time in operation in Lancaster's, let's talk then about the operation, the crew in command of a Lancaster, and what's involved. Firstly, in the training to fly Lancasters?
Well, you did mainly cross countries as a crew to get used to the aircraft and get used to one another, because you hadn't flown together before. And it was always pilot to rear gunner or pilot to mid upper gunner. It was never, you never used Christian names. And we found that, you know, the most satisfactory way to communicate.
Presumably it stopped you being too personally connected to someone that you needed to be operating with on a professional and...
Well, in the air, I think it was the most concise way to handle it. There was no mistake, you know, it was a pilot to navigator, navigator to pilot. There was no mistaking. So we got used to that. And it stood us in good stead. Incidentally, my navigator, he was a crackerjack. I can't speak too highly of him. Even though the others were good, he was extra good.
Well, I wanted to talk about how the crew operated as a team. Obviously, one person couldn't do it all by himself. This is a big plane. It's got four engines.
Yes.
So you're all relying on each other to work as a team.
Sure.
How did that team operate?
Well, our team operated really well as far as I was concerned. The navigator was very concise and he kept us on track all the time. Wireless operator was excellent. On occasions he had to get in code latitude and longitude positions, which he did accurately, and for which I can only speak highly of. The rear gunner got us out of trouble more than once with accurate fire when we were attacked. And the rest of the crew, well, the bomb aimer was excellent. He excelled in some of the raids that we did with the accuracy of his bombing from the photographs, etc., that they had.
Well, let's talk then about, you know, this preparation for operational flying.
From when?
When you were training Lancasters. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how long it was before you literally started to gear up to prepare for your first operational duties.
I'd have to go back to our last lot of flying in the Lancs would have been in September 1944. And from there we went to the squadron on the 28th of September 44.
What did that mean for you?
Well, it meant it was the beginning of the big thrills and the big scare.
All right.
Apart from the scaring that we'd had, training as a crew, we knew that this was the ultimate.
Well, up until that time, had you had any connection with the enemy or experienced any bombing or... strafing at all?
No, not that I can recollect. There was some bombs dropped when we were down Brighton way, but they weren't in close proximity.
Okay, let's talk then about your experience in relation to your first op.
Well,
when was it and where was it to be?
Well, the first operation that I was on was what they call a second dicky trip.
What does that mean?
It means that you go along with an experienced crew on an actual bombing raid, only you, not your crew. Mm-hmm. And I think from my logbook it'll show that I went on a bombing raid with an F.O. Turpening and his crew, and that was on the 11th of October 1944, and it was operation at a fort. It was called Fort Frederick Hendricks. As I remember, it was cloud covered, so we didn't bomb. And we returned with the bombs and went the next day when we did bomb the same target. That was on the 12th of October.
What sort of briefings were you given for an operation like that?
Fairly extensive. You were brought into the briefing room, and the target was up on the wall with the red tape showing the various legs that you would fly, and the final destination or the final target would be shown, and you would be advised by the intelligence officer what to more or less expect. You would get a briefing on the weather that you could expect, the fronts you might have to go over or under, whether the target would be obscured by cloud. I was always impressed by the accuracy that they had with their forecasts.
How did that sort of allay any fears that you might have? Presumably a fairly tense period for a pilot.
You'd have the gut feeling all the time, the fairies in your stomach right from the word go. But I was used to that. I used to get the same feeling with the ordinary flying, let alone going over enemy territory where they were going to have shots at you.
What were they telling you if you were to experience flak, if you were, heaven forbid, to be shot down? What was the plan? What was the plan of action?
There wasn't really any plan. The only time I can recall that we carried extra information on our persons was when we raided Dresden, which was close to the Russian line, and they said if we were shot down around that area, that the Russians didn't ask any questions, they shot first, and it was better that we could produce something to show that we were Allied and not German, because apparently our battle dress was very similar to the German battle dress. That was the only time that I can recall that we had anything extra. They used to issue us with wakey-wakey pills in case we got tired and needed to take them, but I'd never take them myself. And I flew the aircraft manually myself. I never used or relied on the automatic pilot, for which my navigator was very pleased, because with the movement of the rear gunner, he could throw you off course. It acted as a rudder as he swung, whereas I counteracted that. I watched my compass all the time, whereas if it had been the automatic pilot, it might have taken us off course.